At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The good news is that all the big economies in the world are growing. The bad news for this economy, anyway, is that Congress gets back to Washington in a week or two. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 24th of August. Glad, as always, to have you here, everybody. Loath as we are to interpose ourselves between the White House and Congress as the politicking of the American economy gets done, news is news, context is context, and thus here we are. The president this morning once again lit into Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, the leaders, it should be mentioned, of his party in the House and Senate, over there, in his mind, mishandling of the looming debt limit, the government basically running out of the cash it needs to pay our bills come the end of next month. CNBC's Eamon Javers asked White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders today what was up with that.
This morning, the president said that the debt ceiling approval process is a mess. Is it? Is that accurate?
Look, it's our job to inform Congress of the debt ceiling, and it's their job to raise it. And Congress and the previous administration have obligated trillions in spending, and we need to make sure we pay our debts. We're still committed to making sure that gets raised.
The debt ceiling bill?
Yes.
Do you want it to be clean?
Yes.
Sarah.
So far, so good, except for that last little bit there, maybe you didn't hear it so well, about a clean increase in the debt ceiling. That is, with no other must-pass items attached to it. Clean debt increases are always a challenge for House conservatives, especially. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan was asked about that today. Also, as it happens on CNBC, they had a pretty good day.
I'm really not that worried about this. We have plenty of options ahead of us. We will pay our debts and we will make the debt limit. We will hit the increase before this is penetrated, meaning we will pass a debt limit increase before we hit the debt limit.
Just a quick update here. It's 5 weeks from tomorrow until the debt limit hits, which means five more weeks of will they or won't they raise stories. Hint, they will. Okay, out in the global economy, there is more promising news. For the first time in 10 years, all the major economies on the planet are growing. Not all at the same rate, but all at the same time. Specifically, we're talking about the 45 countries tracked by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That's OECD. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath has the story.
You probably remember that the financial crisis didn't just wreck the U.S. economy. It rippled out across the world. The recovery has been uneven and at times nerve-wracking for economists and bankers. You might see economic growth in China, but then a debt crisis in Europe. Russ Kostrich is a global portfolio manager at BlackRock. He says now that all the major economies are growing together, it's a sign the global ship is pointed in the right direction.
And that's important for the direction of interest rates, for the direction of commodity prices, and for the direction of stock markets as well.
But say you're, I don't know, a staunch protectionist, nationalist, anti-globalist policymaker somewhere. Why should you care that the rest of the world's doing well?
A robust global economy is not just good for countries overseas, it's also better news for anyone in the U.S. that's selling anything outside this country.
And it lifts some of the pressure on the U.S. to be the world's economic engine, as other regions play a bigger role.
What we saw last year was the Eurozone actually did better than the U.S. in terms of year-on-year growth, which is quite remarkable.
Karthik Shankaran of Eurasia Group says the old cliche about the U.S. sneezing and the world catching a cold isn't as true right now. The dollar is weak, and the Eurozone probably won't disband. Instead, says Russ Kostrich,
we can make the argument that perhaps the greater source of political risk, it's not Europe, but it's actually here in the United States.
With global growth steady, now when the U.S. sneezes, the world might just say, Gesundheit, and move on. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Among the other questions that Press Secretary Sarah Sanders got today was whether the administration is sticking with plans to hold its annual conference for historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, next month. The answer was a firm yes, despite the United Negro College Fund and others calling on the White House to postpone. President Trump, you might remember, made big promises that those schools would be a priority for his administration, but he has yet to name a director or a board of advisors to oversee his administration's initiative on HBCUs. And that is before you even get to his response to Charlottesville. From the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott has the story.
In the early days of his administration, President Trump signed an executive order to strengthen the country's more than 100 historically black colleges and universities.
With this executive order, we will make HBCUs a priority of the White House, an absolute priority.
All right.
Michael Lomax was in that room. He's president of the United Negro College Fund, which represents 37 HBCUs. Since that February meeting, Lomax says,
the administration, the Department of Education, in our estimation, have not really taken any substantive actions to demonstrate their commitment.
The group has joined the Thurgood Marshall College Fund and Congressional HBCU Caucus in asking the administration to postpone next month's conference. Lomax says members have been frustrated that the White House has yet to appoint people to lead its HBCU initiative. And then came Charlottesville and President Trump's comments that many sides were to blame for the violence.
I think they were a tipping point.
Leslie Baskerville is president of the National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education. She says while the Trump administration maintained funding for HBCUs in its budget, it proposed cuts to other programs that help low-income students.
If you cut off all of those pipeline institutions, our institutions will not have students to enroll and graduate.
Today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters the conference will go on as scheduled and is fully booked. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I'm just going to say the bond market's getting a hair nervous about that debt limit thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to pick up again now with the series that we've been doing about the goods and bads of globalization. It's called Trade-Off. Today, we bring you the four-letter word of global trade, tariff. Yes, I know. There are times when tariffs seem like they'd be a good thing. More often than not, those are times when people in power feel the economy is maybe not working so well for them. But you bring up tariffs in polite conversation with a bunch of economists, they are going to go right to the Smoot-Hawley Act of 1930, perhaps the most infamous of American tariffs, credited by some with tipping us into the Great Depression. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner and Scott Tong have the history of Smoot-Hawley with plenty of lessons for today.
If you believe the movies, this story is the most boring chapter in American history.
The most boring ever.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the, anyone? The Great Depression.
Ah, yes, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, circa 1986. That's the classroom scene.
Passed the, anyone? A tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which...
Ben Stein, comedian and real-life economist, place the teacher while his students snooze, drool, skip altogether the Smoot-Hawley protectionism class.
Bueller.
But it's actually a fascinating tragedy that leads to an economic train wreck.
Our protagonist and tragic hero is Reed Smoot, Republican senator from Utah and the powerful chairman of the Senate Finance Committee.
See, Smoot was a Mormon and a very high-ranking leader of the Church of Latter-day Saints.
A devout gentleman and, as it turns out, a devout protectionist. Back then, the Mormon Church dominated the sugar beet industry out west. Mormon historian Matthew Godfrey has written all about it.
Wilford Woodruff, who was president and the prophet of the LDS Church when they got into the sugar business, said that he had had a revelation from God that the church needed to get into the sugar business.
So Mormon farmers grew beets, and the church controlled a huge sugar company, Utah Idaho Sugar. In a little town that hugs the Wasatch Mountains called Spanish Fork, you can still see the remains of one of the company's sugar beet factories.
Now it's located right by I-15. You can hear the cars going by.
We approach a dark, abandoned space and peek inside. A century ago, this was where the sugar beets were sliced up and ground into a pulp before extracting the sugar.
So it looks to me like there's a chute up there that the beets would drop down into.
Senator Smoot wanted to protect Utah's beet sugar from the imported stuff, mostly cane sugar.
He used kind of very nativistic philosophies of the time, believing that white Americans were kind of the premier race at the time. And so he believed that if you could support an industry that included farmers who were white Americans, that that was more beneficial than relying on sugar that was grown by individuals from Cuba or areas outside of the United States.
Not only was that morally and economically dubious, it wasn't necessary. In the late 1920s, imported crops were not what really sank American farmers. Prices were low all over the world.
But the good protectionists didn't let that fact get in the way.
The Republican Party had to be seen as doing something to help farmers to win the farm vote in the Midwest.
That's Doug Irwin, Dartmouth economist, who wrote the book on Smoot-Hawley. It's called Peddling Protectionism. He says Congress initiates tariff hearings in 1929, at which point our nice little help the farmers package gets hijacked by city folks, a.k.a. Eastern manufacturers.
That's what brings out all the lobbyists and the industry groups saying this is an opportunity for us to sort of piggyback on the farm tariff by getting higher tariffs on ball bearings and steel and textiles and shoes and bricks.
And bottle caps and sprinkler tops.
And collapsible tubs and antimony, whatever that is.
Here's Irwin reading from a section in his book on kraut.
The National Kraut Packers Association called for an increase in the duty on kraut from 30% to 50%. A small farm in Maine requested a duty on canned sardines be raised from 30% to 50%. Someone from Ohio asked the tariff on imported goldfish to be increased to 35%.
The vital pet fish sector.
So how did this happen? Well, have you ever heard of congressional log rolling? Anyone? Anyone? Tong?
Kind of.
Okay. Say we chop down a tree together.
Mm-hmm.
I help you roll a bunch of logs to your house. You help roll some to mine. Or in this case, you support my tariff. I support yours.
Which helps all of us do one thing. Charge higher prices because of less competition. Well, the bill passes the House and it moves over to the Senate. And now we get to Smoot and Smut.
Wait a minute. Did you just say smut?
Yes, I did. Our Mormon protagonist also wants to ban the import of obscene materials.
He took a particular umbrage, for example, at D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover for having obscene passages in it.
You can Google them later.
And apparently he had a big stack of these books saying, you know, this is obscene material. We shouldn't be allowing this in the country. And people were pointing and saying, well, why are you have all these books? What are you doing reading them?
How'd you get them?
Yeah, exactly. How'd you get them?
Smoot smites smut is the famous headline of the day.
So the bill adds that, and it keeps moving. Nobody stops it.
Though a bunch of economists try, 1,028 of them, they write a letter to President Herbert Hoover warning it would lead to higher prices at home and retaliatory tariffs from America's trading partners.
But Congress disses them as blah, blah intellectuals. Take these two Republican senators, reenacted here.
I am not overawed by the proclamation of college professors who never earned a dollar by the sweat of their brow by honest labor.
Free trade intellectuals seem more concerned with the prosperity of foreigners than the well-being of our own American people.
Journalists oppose this, too. But somebody else's voice is entirely missing from this debate. Can you guess who that is? Anyone? Gardner?
I think it was consumers.
You got it. And pay attention here. This is the key to why protectionism is so often a political winner. Consumers who stand to pay a little bit more for sugar or sauerkraut tend not to protest. We'll call it the who cares effect.
Protectionism only sticks consumers with a nickel more here, a nickel more there. So who cares?
But producers, a few producers pocket all those nickels. They care.
So even though it made bad economic sense, the bill made good political sense. And all the industries that successfully lobbied loved it. In June 1930, President Hoover signs Smoot-Hawley into law. And then something happens that those pesky economists predicted, a trade war. Again, Doug Irwin.
Other countries begin to mimic the U.S., saying, well, if the U.S. is going to become isolationist, maybe we should do the same thing as well. So it sort of unleashes this dynamic, the falling dominoes, where other countries move in a protectionist direction as well.
So all this breeds ill will and a rising ultranationalism in Europe in the 1930s.
So what exactly was the damage from Smoot-Hawley's big adventure?
Anyone? Anyone know the effects?
Now, economists generally agree that the bill did not plunge us into depression. We were in the soup already. But it certainly didn't create jobs. And it probably deepened the depression since it shattered world trade. Everybody lost their global customers.
It also flipped the conversation about trade on its head. Up until the 1930s, protectionism was generally seen as a good, sort of patriotic thing.
Smoot-Hawley really just made protectionism a bad word. And it was associated with all sorts of things, declining exports, declining employment, Great Depression, ill will among foreign countries. It really did discredit protectionism as a doctrine in American political life.
The lesson here is a timeless one. Some call it the golden rule of protectionism. Tariff unto others as you would have them tariff unto you.
Bueller.
Sarah Gardner.
Here. Scott Tong.
Present.
For Marketplace.
Coming up.
My 11-year-old is just starting to bull ride.
We are going to the rodeo, gang. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 28 today, about a 10%, 21,783. NASDAQ down 7, also a 10th, 6271. S&P 500 off 5, 2/10 there, 2438. Kind of quiet out there as the markets wait for tomorrow's central bankers meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Janet Yellen, we are looking at you. You know all the fancy coffee that's out there? It means folks are buying less of the old-timey brands like Folgers, which is bad for J.M. Smucker, maker of Folgers, and a bunch of other stuff. Weaker profits reported today. The market soured. Shares down 9.5%. Pork bellies are getting more expensive. Not great for Hormel Foods. Shares off 5.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Taylor Swift's new single drops tonight. The album, Reputation, comes out November the 10th. 1989, her last album sold 1.3 million copies in its first week. But that was 3 years ago, a very long time in a rapidly changing music industry. Marketplace's Aaron Trank reports.
When Taylor Swift's 1989 sold through the roof, it was especially impressive because the album wasn't even streaming. The pop star pulled her music from Spotify and other platforms before putting it back this year. University of Toronto music professor Catherine Moore says she expects the new album will go straight to streaming.
Streaming is the new mainstream radio.
During Taylor's hiatus, streaming grew to account for more than half of music industry revenues. When her tunes were not on Spotify, they were on YouTube. A good place to be, says Monmouth University professor Joe Rapola.
YouTube is the biggest distribution channel of music these days, and so music video has kind of had a resurgence.
With more than 12 billion video views on her YouTube channel, Swift seems primed for an era where MTV's video playlist show TRL will soon be back on the air. Catherine Moore says Taylor's public image over the past few years proves something else about today's music biz.
You don't need to have an album to have visibility.
Swift managed to stay in our news feeds thanks to drama with Kanye West and Katy Perry. Some of that has damaged her brand, says Katie Fettel at marketing firm Teamworks Media.
Her image is pretty carefully cultivated, and I think that's always the interesting balance with her. It's like, how can you be cultivated yet also authentic?
But the singer may have repaired some of that earlier this month when she delivered powerful testimony in a sexual harassment case, which she ultimately won. I'm Aaron Schrenk for Marketplace.
Macy's, that stalwart of shopping malls, that most old school of old school American retailers, is trying to shake things up. Beset by retail's bigger problems the past couple of years and a share price off 42% this year, the company has hired an eBay veteran as president to help turn things around. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Part of Macy's problem is that it's Macy's.
If you look at where they're positioned by selling big name brands like Calvin Klein, Tommy Hilfiger, they're names that you can buy anywhere.
Bridget Weishaar is senior equity analyst at Morningstar, and by anywhere, she means online.
Whether it's on Amazon or from the company's websites themselves, and when that happens, typically you're forced to compete on price.
And when brick and mortar competes with online on price, brick and mortar usually loses. So Macy's wants to sell stuff you can only find at Macy's.
Give people a reason to go to that store.
Diana Smith is with market research group Mintel. Now, there are two ways of doing this. One, develop a special Macy's brand of stuff, kind of like how Costco has Kirkland, if you've ever seen that. Jean-Pierre Dubé teaches marketing at the University of Chicago's Booth School.
The risk is, of course, if these are products that aren't traditionally associated with Macy's, it could inadvertently change its image.
The other way to get exclusive stuff is to convince top brands to make that stuff just for Macy's. Either way, having your own special stuff does not mean people are going to buy it. Again, Morningstar's Weishaar.
This isn't a fix-all because we've also seen Gap struggle in the past, you know, and Victoria's Secret is struggling and they carry all their own brands.
Weishaar says Macy's bigger problem in an age of online sales is less what's in the stores and more that there are just too many of them. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There are big stretches of the rural economy in this country where towns and small cities are dealing with shrinking populations, and as a result of that, a general stagnation. A lot of farms and ranch towns, though, still love them some rodeo, either local amateurs or a full-blown professional event complete with bull riding and calf roping and barrel racing and all of that stuff. After a rough turn during the recession, rodeo continues to kind of stand in for a way to make a living in ranching. So for our series Way of Life, Mitchell Hartman went to the Chief Joseph Days Rodeo in Joseph, Oregon, out near the Idaho border.
If you want to have rodeo riders, you have to teach young people the ropes. Scott Burks has been doing that for decades. He's a team roper. That's an event where two riders work together to rope a steer. He's also a rodeo announcer, and he runs a rodeo Bible camp for teens. He says there's risk in this business, and not just from the big angry animals in the ring.
This is not a cheap sport. You have to go buy a $65,000 truck to pull, you know, $20,000 horse trailer. Then you have the horse flesh. An individual horse can cost you up to $120,000.
There are rodeo Bible camps like the one that Burks runs all over the country. And public prayer and the flag are front and center as the annual rodeo kicks off in the eastern Oregon town of Joseph.
There's one thing I'm quite sure. We're never, ever going to take prayer out of the rodeo arena. Let us pray. Dear Lord, we ask that you watch over each and every one of these cowboys and cowgirls. They compete.
And shortly after, the competition begins. Rural areas like far eastern Oregon have lost resource jobs in timber and ranching over the years. They don't have as many events coming to town as they used to, and the rodeo is a once-a-year celebration drawing families from hundreds of miles around. Terry Jones is the president of Chief Joseph Days. We met in the hospitality tent.
Rodeo business kind of has picked up. We seat about 4,500 people. We've actually seen a pretty good increase in our attendance over the last 7-8 years. We usually sell out on Saturday night,
According to data from the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, the business peaked in the 1990s. Then the number of rodeos and competitors nationwide went into a slow decline. But the rodeos that remain, like in Joseph, are holding their own, with attendance and prize money up. That's in part thanks to family ties to the sport. Whitney Knowles was in the stands next to the animal chutes with her two-year-old daughter to see her husband compete. He's a steer wrestler, and he makes a living on the rodeo circuit with a little help on the ranch at home.
His dad was actually a very good saddle bronc rider, and then his mom, she ran barrels and everything as well. It's passed down generation to generation.
The rodeo also draws generations of the Nez Perce tribe here. They have a teepee encampment, they perform Indian dance and drumming. Skylar White Temple's grandfather was a rodeo competitor.
You know, you have the whole historical aspect of, you know, this being our land. I was talking to my daughter on the way here about this is where we're from. At the same time, it's also just a big family event. They don't do the carnival anymore, but our grandmas and grandpas have been over here for years.
Tia Jones is the daughter of rodeo president Terry Jones. She's a former rodeo princess and Miss Rodeo Oregon, but she's not sure how far she wants her son to go.
My 11-year-old is just starting to bull ride. I was hoping that maybe he would decide that wasn't such a great idea, but instead, it went exactly the opposite.
You say you were hoping it would go the other way because...
Well, I've tried to talk him into roping or something with a horse, but the rough stock is hard on moms, you know, watching your kiddo get on an animal that outweighs him by a few thousand pounds is a little nerve-wracking.
I asked that 11-year-old, though, and he's pretty adamant. He wants to be a bull rider. Runs in the family.
Now out of the hand. Right. Yeah, keep going.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, new-ish French President Emmanuel Macron is having his share of difficulties poll-wise. He is less popular now that he's governing. And this item is not going to help. From the French paper Le Point, news that Macron spent 26,000 euros on makeup his first 3 months in office. That's about $30,000. We called the White House just to compare. It didn't really have an answer. Oh boy, look at the time we got to go. Markets we told you about basically flat down a hair, I guess. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Daniel Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.